Hey, it's me, Brian Reeves. Have you ever considered working with a coach? Like maybe you've achieved success on the outside, but deep fulfillment is still missing inside? Or you're confronted with a massive challenge or choice in your life? Or your relationships aren't as fulfilling as you want them to be? Or maybe you're just tired of trying to figure life out all by yourself? Well, I invite you to apply for private one-on-one coaching with me. Since 2012, I've helped 1,000 men and women like you break through hidden barriers, deepen their relationships, especially the relationship with themselves, and step more fully into the life they were meant to live. Coaching isn't about getting advice. It's about deep transformation so that you can really hear and trust the wisdom and clarity already always within you. I only take on a few clients at a time, and I only work with men and women truly ready to do the work. So if you're up for an inner adventure as a pathway to meaningful change in your outer world, go to brianreeves.com/coaching, click an application link on that page to apply. That's Brian Reeves, Brian with a Y, reeves.com/coaching. The breakthrough you need could begin today. All right, let's get into today's episode.
One of the old ideas is that the world kind of ends and begins again. The word apocalypse doesn't mean fiery end of everything. The original meaning of the Greek word is collapse, renewal. So we're in an apocalyptic time where things collapse. Institutions are collapsing right before our eyes. But there's a hidden renewal that we're not usually seeing. That's happening also. But when things are collapsing, you get polarization.
Welcome to Men This Way. I'm your host, Brian Reeves, Brian with a Y, Reeves. I'm the author of two books and a professional relationship coach and men's coach since 2012. Alongside me as co-host is my lifelong best friend of over 40 years, Tate Arendt. And together we dive deep into the challenges and opportunities we're all facing in the world today. Here we have raw, unfiltered conversations about the topics that matter most to us, like intimacy, purpose, parenthood, spirituality, and much more. Our mission is to reveal the wisdom, insights, and practical tools to empower you to live your best life. All right, let's dive. Well, today, welcome. Oh my goodness, I'm so excited. I'm off to a bumbling introduction immediately. I'm really excited today, Tate. We have an incredible guest, don't we?
Indeed.
We have a really special guest, the one and only Michael Mead. Michael is a master storyteller, mythologist, and author whose work bridges ancient wisdom and modern struggles. With decades of experience weaving myths, psychology, spiritual insight, Michael helps us find meaning in chaos and uncover the hidden genius within ourselves. His words challenge us to see the world as alive, brimming with stories waiting to be told, and reminds us that even in times of crisis, myth offers a map of transformation. Michael, truly, it's an honor to have you on Men This Way. Welcome, sir.
Great to be with you.
I've been following your work for many, many years. I've been transfixed by some of it. I've never gotten to experience you in person. I have friends who have been at your workshops up in particularly Northern California, but I've even watched videos of you where you're drumming and telling stories. I'm like a child, you know, listening to a story. It's so mesmerizing. So yes. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, that's natural humanity. You know, there's an old poet who said, this world isn't made out of atoms, it's made out of stories. And so we're all living stories. We're all trying to unfold our inner story. And right now we're living the story of chaos throughout the world.
We're all living stories. Well, we want to dive into all that with you, including the chaos. We want to talk about rites of passage with you as well. There's a story from your past that I'm eager to hear you share with us here in this forum. But I'm curious just to get us started. What's an early story that you remember hearing in your young life that deeply impacted you or helped shape how you experienced the world?
How young are we talking?
In the womb.
In the womb. Now we're inside my mother's anxiety and fears and the long history of poverty in Irish community. Don't go there. No.
Okay. No. Maybe, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 18. Like you've become a master storyteller. You're masterful at it. We're just curious, like, when did you first understand the power of story and begin to make the choice that I want to become that in my life?
Well, it really started, that level of it started when I was 13. And on my 13th birthday, my aunt gave me a book. She had asked me what I was interested in, and I said history. And she went down to a bookstore to get me a history book. She was notoriously short. She went in and asked where the history books were. They pointed to an upper shelf. She reached up and pulled down a book, had it wrapped, gave it to me. I'm unwrapping this thing, and I see this horse, a flying horse, with a guy sitting on it shooting an arrow. And I'm going, wow, I want this book. And she said, no, it's the wrong book. I'll take it back. And I'm going, no. It's the, and then I ripped the rest of the paper off, and it says Mythology by Edith Hamilton. So that night at 13, I read most of that book, which opened up this language that had things in it, had imagination, had ideas and themes that they weren't talking about in school or in church, and certainly not in my house. And I got like initiated into another world of imagination. And then I spent about 20 years figuring out, forgetting about it, remembering it, and then figuring out how to live with that level of story.
Yeah, you've spoken a lot about the importance of myth, and we've kind of opened this conversation because myth can be so helpful in helping us to navigate chaos. The world knows and has known and will know. Why do you think that ancient stories are so relevant in today's world?
Myths in the modern world, the word myth in the modern world means something untrue. People are always saying that's just a myth. The word myth in its own origins, it means something closer to emergent truth. And so the deep truths of life, the universal truths, you don't find in the newspaper very much, and you don't find it online in the common news distribution very much. You find it in these ancient stories, so that the example I often use is Icarus, you know, who flies too close to the sun, and then the wax holding his wings on melts and he falls straight into the sea. And so in the modern world, you watch rock and roll musicians rise to the top, and all of a sudden things start to melt and they go down. Hollywood starlets. Nowadays, TikTok influences are very young and they rise and they go down. And so the way to understand that is through that old story, which is to say, if we fly too close to the sun, something, and we're not held together very well psychologically, so we're going to have a meltdown. That would be the way to interpret it. And now that's very common. You have careers that go up fast and come down fast. Same thing is true in hip hop. Well, in rap and hip hop. And so that's an example of an ancient story explaining to some degree a modern experience.
I reflect on this, I don't know, as I've been studying over the years, mythology, and I'm particularly drawn to Norse mythology. I don't know, I think the History Channel did that show Vikings. Regardless of its historical accuracy, I was just enamored with that time period and how present the gods were in their stories and their lives, how relevant it was to their daily lives. And how, you know, we've, in my modern world, growing up here in America, you know, as a white guy from the East Coast, all I was told, the only myth story I really had was the Jesus story. And I don't know, the way that it was offered to me in church on Sundays wasn't very compelling. It for me personally, it wasn't enlivening. It felt very deadening, actually. And I wonder, you know, what do you see when you look into the culture? Because we're going to tell stories. We're going to tell myths, right? As you said, we're living stories. What are some of the predominant stories that we're living right now that maybe we're not even conscious of, that maybe don't serve us?
Two big ones. One is people think that it's right against left and Democrat against Republican and liberal against conservative, and all kinds of polarized oppositions. People think they're living in two different stories. We're all living in the same story, the story of when the world gets polarized. There's a misunderstanding. We're actually living out the conflict of the opposites on a literal scale, which otherwise would be found in stories on a philosophical, mythological, psychological scale. So it's very mythical what we're going through. And the second big story that I think is even bigger myth is the story of chaos and creation. So, and the way I see that, well, on a creation level, creation stories are about how things manifest into reality and come from the unseen. So the beginning of most creation stories is called chaos, but it's described as an endless extent of dark water. And from that dark water, there begins to be, in tribal cultures, it would be a sound that's resonating. In more modern cultures, but not modern like now, it would be the word at the beginning. But anyway, it begins in darkness and chaos, and then creation comes. And what's happening now, I think we're at the end of an era. We're at the close of an era, particularly in the Western world. And everything that we thought was going to get fixed didn't quite get fixed. You know, the Enlightenment produced dark energy, dark matter, and black holes. And so it's gone away that people didn't expect. And we're at the end of that. And at the end, everything gets chaotic, because chaos is also the beginning. It's what happens at the end. But the chaos from that becomes the next worldview, the next way of understanding the world. And so that's the big thing behind everything, I think.
Well, I mean, it's profound. I'm thinking of the thing of the myth of the, we're in the myth story where things are dividing, where there's a polarity, a polar opposite experience happening. And, you know, the foundation of my existence, you know, the wounding of my childhood, parents, you know, family separating. So much of the work that I do is the intent of it is to bring people together, is to create connection, to get. And I find myself caught up in the polarizing conversation. As much as I don't want to be contributing to that, you know, we talk politics, and I care about the politics of the world. It's like I can't escape that, Mike. Michael, I can't escape it.
No, we can't. Everything that enters the culture becomes polarizing. Everything. You name it, whether it has to do with bathrooms or it has to do with, immigration, whatever it is, it polarizes. Things that you thought would bring people together polarize.
Yeah.
And so living a myth. We're living in a myth.
Michael, how did we get here? What were the seeds of the story that were planted that led us to this polarized experience?
One of the old ideas is that the world kind of ends and begins again. The word apocalypse doesn't mean fiery end of everything. The original meaning of the Greek word is collapse, renewal. So we're in an apocalyptic time where things collapse. Institutions are collapsing right before our eyes. But there's a hidden renewal that we're not usually seeing. That's happening also. But when things are collapsing, you get polarization. So the institutions that were invented, let's say in America, in a democratic culture, the institutions are there to protect everybody. And the institutions cannot keep up with the radical nature of change and the intensification of polarization. And so the institutions are rattling and not working. And polarization takes over. So a culture would have some kind of what used to be mythic understanding that gave them coherence. In the modern world, it's not so much mythic, it's more scientific and philosophical. And that which held us together is now breaking apart. People disagree about everything. But I'll add one other thing, because it was already mentioned. The other way to look at the big story is that we're in the middle of a rite of passage. And the three steps of the rite of passage are separation. In youthful rite of passage, the girl or boy leaves childhood behind and doesn't go right into adulthood. They go into a mysterious interaction with nature and older people that is supposed to bring a revelation of themselves to themselves. That's the first step, separation. Well, we just went through COVID where we were literally separated. But in the meantime, we've been psychologically separated into polarized divisions. The second step is the liminal area, the place of betwixt and between, which is another way to understand polarization, where betwixt and between one thing and another, on a collective level, we're betwixt the end of the old world and the envisioning of the next world. And that's the area of ordeal and descent, confusion and awakening. And then the third step would be a return. If it's on a collective level, it's a little hard to explain. On an individual level, the return, the young person now comes back conscious and aware of themselves to be welcomed by a community that's waiting for them and wants to bless them for the becoming themselves. So if you take rite of passage, which is like a ritual enacting of a myth, we're in the middle. We're in the liminal stage, betwixt and between. And in that stage, the only way through is be creative. We have to participate in a recreating of our own lives and a recreating of the world.
Wow. I mean, I'm just getting chills. There's just a million rabbit holes I want to go down here with you. One thing that I've observed and I've wondered myself, I like to watch The Daily Show, Jon Stewart, you know, and his work. I've watched it for many years. And I've seen, you know, here's a man that I believed could have great impact on the culture, you know, in a way could speak reason into the world such that, you know, order the chaos in a way such that we would actually find our sanity again. And I've noticed, you know, even John, when he you know, in his humorous ways acknowledges is how pretty much nothing that his show has ever done has prevented us from getting to where we are today in this chaos. And I'm struck by that because there's a part of me, Michael, that is tempted to cynicism, is tempted towards, well, what the fuck difference does it make? Why even bother? You know, I'm just riding a tidal wave into a chaos and destruction. And maybe that's true. I wonder, is that what's happening? But obviously the answer isn't cynicism. What I'm hearing you say, the response is creativity.
Yeah. Cynic is another Greek word, which has to do with dogs. And the cynic is someone who's chewing on a bone that has no more nutrition in it.
I love that.
Cynic.
It's so descriptive.
Cynic is also a once upon a time idealist. Only people with ideals become cynical. You have to have ideals and lose them to become cynical. And so I just did a podcast, I think it came out today, on how despair, the loss of hope, despair is a French word, and the middle of it is SPR, which is the French for hope. Despair is to have no hope. And people think, like cynicism, people think despair is an end point, but it turns out there's a second level of hope underneath despair. And that level of hope has to do with imagination and creativity, not with naivete and wishfulness. And so, another way to understand what's going on is we're in a descent and no one is excluded. Jon Stewart, no one is excluded. We're being pulled down. The things that held everything together are not working. And of course, comedy has always had the purpose of bringing down those that are too high, leveling things and bringing everybody together in the deep sense of humor. And the word humor comes from the old Latin word humus, which means earth. And so comedians are supposed to be earthy and they're supposed to bring everybody together in mutual earthiness, but now you can't do it. The earth itself is like divided. It's just a radical time. But we need the comedians and we need the artists and the musicians and the poets, but we need everybody to be more creative than usual.
You know, I'm really present to what you just said, which is that we're all in the descent. But one of the things that I'll just note is that what we are tending to do in this moment is to turn on each other and to blame each other for the descent that we are all in.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And you know, one of the concepts that Brian and I work with in our men's group is we talk about there are five dead ends for us as men in the world. I'd be curious to get your thoughts on these. The first is the one that we've actually already talked about, which is cynicism. Right. If a man is beholden to his cynicism, he goes down a dead end path, which is if he stays there, he will stay inside of darkness and not find a way to come to light fully.
No nutrition on that bone.
With no nutrition on that bone. I'm stealing that.
I love that.
the second dead end that we see for men is the ways in which we have a tendency to isolate, to go it alone, to lone wolf it, to be on our own and to hunker down when things get tough. The third is the ways in which we have a tendency to numb out in the world, to try to help alleviate the pain of the moment with some short-term pleasure that can give us a quick hit, but nothing of substance that sustains us. The fourth is the ways in which a dead end, which is being disoriented, which is not having clarity about what direction we need to go in. And fifth is we might know where we need to go, but we feel powerless to do or sustain action in ways that are meaningful. I'd be curious just from a myth story or right to, you know, from your paradigm, what's your response to what we believe are five dead ends for us as men?
I think it's great. I think it's great. I think there's truth in all of those. The one place I would pick up a thread is in disorientation. You know, I was involved with men's work starting, I don't know, 35 years ago, when there wasn't anything going on. But we called it soul work. And the whole idea was that because of the dissociations inside modern culture that were there and now are worse, people are losing their souls, including men. And when a man doesn't have a soul, he's become not just cynical, but typically crude or mean. You know, that's where the bully comes from and so on. So, but in doing that, I found that the step before finding a meaningful orientation is disorientation. And, you know, when someone is lost, being lost is the way to being found. And so just to play with that a little bit. So when we were starting to do men's work, the idea was everybody comes and no one has a higher position because the soul is kind of an equalizing, connecting entity, substance. And the idea was for everybody to descend to the level of the soul. And so I agree with you. Those things are dead ends. And a lot of many men, I've been there myself, you know, just spinning wheels or just casting blame because I can't find my way out. But the other thing that I've worked on a lot, and I've experimented this with gangs, men in prison, women in prison for that matter, but also all kinds of extreme situations with men, refugees, battle veterans. The question I usually ask is, do you know that you have genius in your soul? And I've asked that of armed gang members who go, what? Wait, what do you mean? Because everybody kind of knows what genius is. And so it's a word that you can use in lots of levels of culture. And the idea is when I'm disoriented, when I'm stuck, when I've gone numb, I have dissociated from something in my soul that is not just alive, it's uniquely alive. Each person is unique. Nature, no two cedar trees are the same. No two ravens are the same. No two people are the same. And when you live in a big collective society that has lost its soul, it's easy to think that you are empty inside when the thing we're looking for is deep inside. And so, I agree with those five things. And then my sense is find a dead end, get stuck, go numb, and then we'll go to work. Now let's go to work. Let's find out what's underneath that.
Well, I really appreciate your you know, picking up the thread on disorientation, particularly because I think about, man, the times that I've spent disoriented in my life. Oh, excruciating and painful, and yet absolutely essential for the next evolution of my life, the next chapter to come online.
Yeah, if people had just told us that we're secretly carrying the thing we're looking for, and we have a deep self or soul, whatever you want to call it, that knows why we're here, then you could say, in the disorientation, we're separating from the daily world, but not to get lost, but to get found.
It brings me to the story that I would really love to talk with you about that happened to you earlier in your journey as a man. I heard you share the story. I was listening to one of your many brilliant courses over the years. I was actually driving up the mountains to a cabin in the mountains in just outside of Los Angeles, Idlewild. And it was at nighttime. And so the mood was just right. I was on this windy road. I'm listening to you tell your story about the time that you spent in solitary confinement and what happened there. Would you briefly take us through that experience in your life and what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, that was an informal underworld initiation or rite of passage that I didn't know I was going into. So I'm 19 years old and I get drafted to go to Vietnam, and I send a letter back saying, listen, it's not a declared war. It doesn't look like a wise war. It looks like an unjust war. So I'm not going to come. But if you have another war, let me know. That was my my attempt at authentically responding to the Vietnam. Yeah. And so I didn't get a response. They came knocking on the door and they said, you either go into the military or you go to jail. And so you had mentioned East Coast. I grew up in New York and in a more or less Irish-American community where everyone was in favor of the war. And when I asked my mother, what she said, well, our sons always go to war, which I thought was a little general and a little bit dismissive. Anyway, I didn't have enough 19-year-old courage to say, damn it, I'm not going. I'll go to prison. So I went into the Army. No one had told me that what happens in the Army is they give you orders all the time. I don't do orders very well. So they're giving me orders and I'm going, nah, I won't do that one. What else you got? You know,
oh, anyway. I can so relate to this.
Yeah. Okay. What other war you got?
Yeah. And so things got worse and worse until I was court-martialed. And then I was court-martialed again. And then I was finally put into a military prison. And guess what they do in a military prison? They give you orders all the time. And I said, no, I ain't doing orders. So the only place left to go was very far down into a solitary confinement cell where I was for months.
Wow.
And so this is the descent. This is what caused me to study initiation and rites of passage. When I did get out, I had to understand what happened because I'm as alone as I can be. I occasionally have guards that come and give me a hard time. But otherwise, I'm by myself in a 9x12 cell that's really dark at night and only has some light in the daytime. And I go through every level of pain that I had ever experienced all over again. And I think I'm just going to die like this. And all of a sudden, I start having visitors in my solitary cell that were characters from myths. Characters from stories like Odysseus and Athena, they would come and like talk to me. And so now I'm in a new level that isn't pain anymore. It's actually kind of brilliant, but I'm afraid or I'm questioning, am I losing my mind or am I kind of finding my mind? And I decided I'm finding my mind. And so I took the advice of characters from myth and I felt not alone in solitary confinement. I had a deeper sense of self that, in psychological terms, that was companioning me. And that allows me to survive it. And when I got out, I was looking for how do I understand this? Because talk about disorientation. I'm an utter stranger in a strange world. I mean, I couldn't connect back to my family. No one in my neighborhood understood what I was doing. And I was post-traumatic as well. So I began to study the anthropology of initiation rites of passage. I began to study psychology. I went back to studying myth. And I was eventually put it all together as an underworld initiation that helped reveal something in myself that could not be rescinded or defeated or denied. And then that led me actually to become a storyteller and to work with mythology and to work with people in pain and in suffering and in states of rejection.
You know, Michael, one of the things I'm present to, and maybe you don't see it this way, but what I'm present to is what you went through is an extreme example of an accidental rite of passage. And to a large extent, I think that that's what many of us, again, yours is an extreme example of that, but we have a lot of accidental rites of passage, things that people don't intend to happen to them, traumas or difficulties or challenges that aren't by design, but they are by outshoot of the pain and the suffering of the elders or the olders that have come before us. And what I'm present to is that we really don't have very many anyway. I know that the Jewish faith, Judaism, they do some really interesting things around rites of passage with bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. But in my growing up, when you got your license or you got the ability to drink, those were two rites of passages. And beyond that, it's really hard for me to identify intentional rites of passages that our society is going through right now. And I guess given that overwhelming missing rites of passage, what do you think those of us that are aware of this can and should be doing in our families, in our communities, in our cultures, in our businesses, to bring back rites of passages that are intentional?
I agree with everything you said. Modern culture has forgotten a lot of things, a lot of wise things. And before modern times, rites of passage existed in almost every culture. It was a natural response to the end of childhood. It was a psychological response to the intensity. We started out talking about men. Young men, when they go from being a boy, and now it's not just that the hormones change, that's a modern view. The inner psychic life of a young guy changes. Young people begin to have big dreams when they're 12 or 13. It's supposed to be a step into a bigger life. And there is, when there's no formal process for that, then it has to happen informally and accidentally, because it is a necessary requirement for the human psyche. What's missing is something that's necessary. And yes, you can find some elements of it in bat mitzvahs and bar mitzvahs and in certain Christian things and so on, but they're mixed in with dogma. And so you're being fed a belief system when you're supposed to learn how to believe in yourself. And so it gets a little bit confused. So the closest thing I've seen to it in modern times is Vision Quest, because it's very clear. You're on a quest. That is to say, there's a big question about who you are, why you're here, and what you're supposed to do. And you're looking for a vision that informs that quest and questioning. And then it involves nature, which takes it out of the dogma world and puts it into the world of nature and the power of nature to change things. And then what's missing or sometimes present is the elders who actually understand that process, not just generally, but can specifically see how it's happening in that young person and help them put together the elements of vision and dream with the experiences that they're having, you know, at that particular time of life. So Vision Quest is one way to get back to it. And the reason I recommend that more than other things is because of the role of nature. The elders or the mentors who would be guiding a Vision Quest have to have gone through something that turns them inside out. And so that they begin to know their inside so deeply that they can empathize, sympathize with the insides of other people. And that's where the problem can come in. As far as I'm concerned, if someone takes a dogmatic approach and these are the steps and here's how it works, then it may kind of work or it may not. The trick is that person who's going through the quest has inside them the dream that they're trying to awaken to, has inside them genius qualities that they need to live with, has inside them gifts that they need to give to life and other people, and has inside them pain and wounds that need to be healed somehow. And if people work with that, then you can kind of remake the rites of passage. But the engagement with nature is the part that says You cannot completely codify this. Nature is changing in ways that you can't predict, and the rites of passage have to have elements that you can't predict.
Yeah, it's funny as you're sharing that. First off, I've been my younger days, and I wonder if this is true. Imagine, I'm sure this is true for a lot of young men. I was unwittingly trying to initiate myself in various capacities. I once went and attempted to spend 3 days in a cave. My dad and my stepmom actually dropped me off at the front of this cave, and I walked like a mile into it. You could drive into this cave. It's more like a quarry kind of thing. Anyway, I was 19. I brought grapes and candles, and I had no idea what I was doing. I just like the initiation was on my mind. Let me go do this. And Michael, I was bored. I was so bored after 12 hours. I walked back out. I was like, screw this. Later, I did an actual vision quest in the south of Chile, in the mountains of Chile, with an organization that was offering that experience. And I did a 4-day, sitting in nature, and it too was, indeed, being in nature. It was profoundly revealing in meaningful ways. And though I came out of that, there wasn't really anybody tending me in that experience, stewarding me. I was still kind of on my own, even in that. And then I came back into my world back in America. Nobody even really wanted to ask me about it, I think, because it was just weird. And so it's like, I spent so much of my younger days clamoring, screaming out, initiate me. Nobody picking up the call.
That's the story. I mean, and to move it forward, when young men are not initiated into an awareness of their own suffering, they do not learn to respect the suffering of other people. And when young people are not awakened to who they already are inside themselves, they can enact things that are not natural or not conscientious for them. And to take it one step further, when those who didn't go through meaningful, deep awakening, initiatory experiences, who then are being given large amounts of power, they will misuse that power. They will misuse it because they don't know the source of power. They think it's their power. When if you're in nature, you realize there's being things a lot bigger than you. And if a person doesn't know how they're wounded, they will wound other people. And I'm sorry to say, now in the split condition of the world, in the midst of the chaos, people are electing those who claim to know how to fix things and do not know how to fix things. And those who want power but don't know what power is for, just to say how wrong it can go.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I'm just to come back to this conversation of rites of passage, Brian and I came up with this idea of creating a year-long experience for men out of the, we call it Elevate 2025. We have 10 men each year. We've been doing this since 2021. And out of each of our own individual experiences of not having elders to initiate us, his father, Brian can tell the story certainly better than I can, constantly telling him one day I'm going to tell you what it means to be a man in the world. And that day never came, right? And him telling that story planted the seed in me when my son was 5 and now he's 10 about, I really want to create an experience for my son, having not had it myself. And I'm thinking about the listener here, that a man or woman is listening and they've got a 10 or 11 or 12 year old, and they know they're on the cusp of needing to initiate their son or their daughter into that transitionary, that liminal space that you were talking about earlier. What would you recommend? That what are the elements of rites of passage that parents should be thinking about having or experience that help us craft an experience for a 13, 12, 13, 14 year old as a parent? What should we be doing?
Okay, good question. But I have to say, parents typically cannot initiate their own children. And when you study where rites of passage existed or sometimes now still exists in the world, the whole thing is at the end of childhood, the girl, the boy is supposed to leave the family and then be guided by other things, dreams, visions, and people who have been through dreams and visions, because the family gives birth to a child but does not recognize the genius nature of their child. It's unusual for the parents to be able to see the genius of their child. Genius is the old Latin word that nowadays means talent or smarts, IQ. But the meaning of it is the spirit that's already there. So when a child is born, you have the child that you see, and you have the spirit that you can't see. And we know something about the spirit of our own children. I'm a father of four. You can recognize things, but you very rarely can see what that life is aimed at. And then usually a family has its own interests and its own idea of what the child should do. And all traditional cultures said at the end of childhood, that child leaves the family, enters nature, and enters a radical experience of self-awakening, where the essence of who they are becomes more conscious. And that's not a family function. And so I have to just have to say that.
Yeah,
because on a psychological level, the way they say it is the parent and the child, the experience between them is polluted. And it doesn't mean anybody's bad. It just means the expectations are different. The child always feels wounded by its parents, always. Everyone is an abandoned child because no family can give the child what it really needs. That's why everybody has to leave the family. Now, once you're out and you find out who you are, you look back and you see everything differently. But so parents in the modern world have a big problem, and in the contemporary world have a bigger problem by far than anything that was going on when I was growing up. It's more severe now because the kids are absorbing from the atmosphere and the information atmosphere of the culture that the world might end because of climate crisis, that it might end because of nuclear war, that it might end because of any kind of a pandemic. And so kids now have fear of the world and fear of the future. And so it's a big job, and it's a real concern for parents. So the few things I could say without having to get into real particulars is that anything that takes the child out and to where they can explore the world and what they're interested in, and that can happen in sports, and it can happen in the arts, and it can happen in contemplative process too. And then anything that puts them in nature, because modern culture thinks that humans are separate from nature, but human nature is connected to nature. And a lot of ancient cultures, like the tribal groups in North America, said that each person has a second soul, and the second soul is connected to something in nature, which for some people is trees, for others it's a certain animal. So there's a discovery thing that can happen. But to institute rites of passage would not be the job of the parents. The hardest thing for the parents is to let the child really go. But that's the only thing to do if you want the child to have a meaningful life. By the way, in a culture where the parents and the family doesn't let the child go, that means the parents stop following their initiatory path. You get parents that are still checking in on their grown children because they're not on their own unfolding path. We've really lost a dynamic that is what comes after family, and which eventually affects all the families to come, which is to say the individual girl or boy becomes a more awakened individual. And that's the only way we're going to renew culture, is through a greater awakening that has to have somewhat of an initiatory quality.
Oh, man, it's fascinating. Again, just rabbit holes all over the place. I want to dive down with you. But I'm curious, Michael, some of the, the elders that I've learned from over the years, Francis Weller, a brilliant, brilliant man, brilliant teacher, that use this term, the long dark, to describe this time period that we're entering into, this descent, this collective descent, right, that we're all a party to, whether we like it or not. The long dark, something that will likely be measured certainly not in months or years, but decades, if not generations. I'm curious to hear from you, what do you think about this time we're entering into? Are you optimistic? Are you frightened for us? Are you concerned? Are you, I mean, like, just how, as an elder, how do you hold what's happening for us? And you've shared a lot already, but I'm, you know, taking us a bit deeper into it.
In ancient India, they called it the Kali Yuga. Kali meaning dark and Yuga meaning long time.
Okay.
And so we're in the dark times. I think it's a proper way to, I always refer it back to the Enlightenment. Remember the Enlightenment? They thought everything was going to be solved. You shine a light on it and everything gets solved. Right. And then they shined the light out into the universe and found dark energy, dark matter. They didn't find solution. They found mystery. And so the darkness is also the time of the mystery. And so we're really being invited back into the mystery. And the closest I can find to describing the mystery that has been the living mystery for humans throughout time is life, death, and renewal, or birth, death, and rebirth. And the darkness is the descent into the womb again, or the descent of the caterpillar into the chrysalis or the cocoon. We're descending in order to be reborn, in order to be remade. That's happening on a very big scale, and then it's happening on all levels of culture. And it has always happened. The darkness is, the poet Hafez says, let the darkness season you. In other words, your instinct to go at whatever age that was into a cave is a brilliant instinct. I mean, think of Plato in the cave. The word therapy or therapist comes from the Greek therape. And the therapes lived in caves where they interpreted people's dreams who slept in the cave in order to have a vision. I mean, and caves are inside the earth. It's like going back inside the mother to the womb. And so there's things that are waiting to be learned. And so am I afraid? Yes, I'm very afraid. And I'm real fearful for young people because right at the time when it becomes most important that they have some kind of rite of passage or initiatory experience, they are given their own personal devices in order to disconnect them further from who they actually are. So we have things, you know, that they have to struggle with and that we have to penetrate in order to help them. At the same time, we're not of any use to young people if we're not on our own initiatory path. Because young people watch the older people and they pay a lot of attention. And when they see someone that is unusual to them, that seems to be in a meaningful life, even though they're older and seems to have some character, that they can absorb that and they can, you know, learn from that. So I think we're in a very difficult time, but I draw confidence and imagination from the idea that the darkness is where creation comes from, and that in a funny way, so you could say when a person is numb, they're actually closer to waking up than they are when they're in the everyday mode. When a person is hurting, they're closer to finding a blessing. And when we find ourselves in darkness, we just have to remember that the soul used to be called the light hidden in the dark. There's our soulful aspects of ourself that have been trying to awaken throughout our lives that tend to awaken in darkness. And so, and I'm not saying that I don't have concerns and fears. I really do. But what I went through in that solitary confinement had taught me something about solitude and darkness, and that things can appear and arise that I wasn't aware of that turned out to be essential to my own way of being and seeing the world. And so I'm trusting in that.
Yeah. And as we were talking earlier about these five dead ends that men find themselves in, whether or not the cynicism or the isolating or the, you know, the numbing out, all of those things. One of the things that Brian and I are stands for is that men learn how to do two things, to be able to show up in their lives and to be able to speak up in their lives. And you are often known as saying that the world is alive and waiting for us. What, in your mind, what does it really mean to truly show up for the world in the way that you describe?
I mean, I try to work at these things and they're all hard or difficult to put into words. And some of them are ineffable, but you have to try. So I wrote a book called The Genius Myth, and I was intentionally putting together two words that are commonly known and equally misunderstood. One I've already talked about, where myth is emergent truth rather than untruth, and genius that I referred to. And so the idea is that each person is supposed to have a genuine awakening experience of their own genius. And once that happens, paths open up, ways of seeing and ways of being become more conscious. And once that's going on, then the next step is to realize that each person has a calling. Each person has a calling in life. My calling has to do with mythology, and it called to me from the right, wrong book that I accidentally on purpose received. I mean, the whole thing is right. The fact that my aunt says, no, it's the wrong book. No, it is. It was a mistake that was the exact right thing. And so the world does that. There's an old saying, it's not just that the wanderer is thirsty, it's also that the well needs to give its water to someone. And so the world is offering us things. But those five things you mentioned obscure the capacity to see and feel what's trying to come. So when we started doing men's work a long time ago, there was nothing of the kind going on whatsoever. And I suggested early on that we use the three favors of rites of passage, that we consider it to be a rites of passage. But early on, I realized that if I start saying this is a rites of passage and here's how we do it, I will have fallen into a trap, because then you have to expand on the dogma, and then you have to protect it. And so what we did was just each event was brand new. And the idea that I eventually learned was, in the midst of an event, we usually would have about 100 men at a time, and it would be diverse intentionally. Because one of the things we had to figure out early on is, or the question was, is it men's work or white men's work? In other words, if it didn't invite and involve men of all kinds and all orientations, then what kind of work is it? And so once we got through that, then my idea was, I trust that the soul is going to manifest in some or all of us. And then, of course, I had this orientation with stories. So I put everything into a story, and then I invite everyone into the story. And going back to the idea of the voice, which is so important, each person has a chance to voice where they are in the story and how it connects to their own life. And then once you make clear that if it's painful, oh, that's where we intended to go, we're not going to back away from it, what happens is the wounds start to come out. And when the wounds come out, the cultural, racial, ethnic differences disappear, because the wounds are similar in all kinds of people. And the next thing, you're doing healing work. And so what is often not made clear about rites of passage, I see it as two things. One, you're trying to reveal the gifts and the genius of the person. And the other, you're trying to begin the healing of the wounds they already have. Because everyone is wounded in childhood. It's just a human thing. And if you want men to be real, get to the wound. And if that makes sense.
Well, it does. I mean, in our year-long journey that we take 10 men through every year, we call it Elevate, but the first, 4 or 5 months, we're doing descent work. We're touching the wound. We're going into the wound, into the shadow, into the stuff that men are not either don't want to look at or haven't looked at, but they're ready to. We go there, we descend in service of ultimately helping them find their genius. But we, I think a lot of, we're 50, we're men of a certain age. I remember when I started doing this work in my late 30s, idealistic and overly simplistic and wanted to just run around all of these, bypass all the things that I didn't want to look at. Just all I wanted to do was elevate. I didn't want to do descent work. I wanted to elevate. And so now, I think just also having been humbled by life in so many ways, get this far, to not be just dead men walking, right? There's a lot of humbling that we have to embrace.
No, well said. Yeah. And that humbling was always a part of the rites of passage. That's why people would be naked or without food or have to stay up all night. It was to humble the ego, in a sense, to shatter the ego so the deep self could arrive. And once that arriving of the deeper thing is happening, you don't have to have rules and regs. You just have attention, and you go where the person needs things to go, and you bring forth what's in you. Because the other thing that we learned early on was that the mentors, teachers, guides, whatever we're going to call them, elders, have to be humble. And the idea is if someone is holding themselves in an elevated position, that automatically keeps everybody in a descended position. And so we found that the work would kind of invert so that the deep things are elevated. I think calling it elevate is fine. We just say it's the deep stuff we're going to elevate. We have a culture with elevators and lots of escalators, but we're going to elevate what is not allowed to go onto the elevator, so... Yeah.
And there's, as we've talked about, there's two different ways to have a rite of passage. One is accidentally and the other is intentionally. And most of us are having accidental, rites of passage. That we get the house, the car, the boat, the kids, the wife, everything that we thought that we wanted and needed to be able to have the fulfilling life, only to find out that comes up short. And everybody does. We cleverly call the program Elevate because we know that men want to, but intuitively men know that they've had accidental success that hasn't felt like significance. And they now know that there's something more intentional that they have to be willing to go through, some descent work that they have to be willing to go through, so that when they elevate, they can stay there and not be drawn back into that more accidental deaths. We do die time and time again, and it's necessary for the regular rebirth that's happening. And one of the things that you're such a brilliant storyteller. I guess I'm curious right now, given the conversation that we have, given the culture, given where we're at as a society, what is one of your favorite short myth stories that you could share that you think is really important for people to have in mind right now?
Okay. So of course, as a storyteller, you want to elaborate big stories and so on, but some I carry more like kernels or nuts. So in trying to understand how could it be that a person could live the majority of their life and have various levels of success, like you were describing, and not know who they are. How could that be? What's going on here? How is it that most people don't know who they are? And how is it that people keep electing people who will never know who they are? Sorry, that's my little political aside. Anyway, so I found this story in an old a book of African tales that was out of print when I found it. And it takes up maybe four paragraphs on one page. And it explains how it is that we don't know what we're supposed to do, even though we're here to do something pertinent. And so the story starts in the other world, and it starts with the world tree. And the world tree is like the mother of all trees. And on the world tree, on the branches of it, is where the souls are sitting. This is before they enter the world. And the souls are watching this world, the daily world, the common world. And they're watching like, I guess, TV or, like a series on TV where it's quite interesting. And then they see something that's happening in the manifest world that's totally compelling. And then the soul goes, okay, I'm going to go into that world. And as soon as the soul decides to go, a spirit shows up, and the spirit explains to the soul, here's what this is going to be like. You made your choice based on an imagination you had. And now this is how your life is going to be shaped. And then the spirit says, this is so interesting. I'm going to go with you. So now the soul and the spirit are traveling together, and they come into a garden, and they come before another great tree. They just left the world tree. And the soul goes, I have to embrace this beautiful tree before we go on. And as soon as the soul touches the tree, it forgets what it had just been told by the spirit and what it had seen that was causing it to go to be born. And then the soul was born into the world. So that's the most condensed story that I've ever found that explains why it is that we are aimed at something. I call it the destiny. We're aimed at a destination, but we don't know it. And when we're born, our family doesn't know it. They're just doing family things. And each family is actually a story of fate descending through time. Each family has its own fateful issues. And then what happens in rites of passage, we are awakened to what we forgot in order to be born. Inside us is the knowledge we're looking for. Native American people called it the medicine you're born with. There's medicine inside us. And so, but we have forgotten it. And now in the modern world, people have forgotten almost everything. They forgot that the mystery was life, death, and renewal. They forgot that we were here to become capable of expressing love and feeling pain and being involved in healing. And they forgot we were all carrying some genius elements intended to be given to the world. So that's one of my favorite little stories that condenses a lot of philosophy. Yeah. And so each birth is a beginning and a forgetting. And then each rebirth is a remembering. And we remember parts of ourselves that were forgotten when we came into the world of time and place. And so it's all based on the idea there's something eternal or divine inside people, and not on a dogmatic, religious level, on a basic level that everyone's carrying. Modern science has figured that from the Big Bang, which was this bursting of a star in a sense, that everything that lives has a speck of that original star, which means there's a speck of star in everyone. And that's the light inside the person. And when we find that inner speck of star, suddenly we're not helpless. We actually know what to do. And it doesn't have to be a heroic thing, which is the other thing that's a problem in the world. People think the hero's myth is the only story, when there's stories where the person's gift is empathy, and their job and their calling is to sit close with people and feel their pain and help and empathize with their attempt to deal with their pain and deal with their awakening. And so science is actually catching up to this in some ways, but myth had it all along.
I'm present as you share that with that Mark Twain quote, the two most important days of our lives, the day we were born and the day we find out why.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the calling. So here's a helpful idea in the long dark. When the world is in chaos, there's an acceleration of calling. People are resisting now the descent, and people are resisting the sense that this could all change. People are terribly captured in uncertainty, and uncertainty generates fear, and fear generates exclusion, and on it goes. But the old idea is that in that darkness, something is trying to awaken, and in our own souls, any opportunity can be the opportunity to find our voice and to find our calling. And so they say now that a young person going to, higher education is likely to have six or more careers during their life because the world is changing so fast. And so then my suggestion is, since that's the case, there's no given reason to study a particular thing. Get some general education and go on the second adventure. The first adventure is growing up. The second adventure, like you said, is finding out who you already are. And so people should be going into caves, and they should be going into strange practices and arts and all kinds of things, because the idea of finding a career and living it and getting the house and the cue cards and everything, that's gone. It was empty all along, but now it's gone, especially for young people. And so we're more by necessity, we're closer to the calling and closer to the second adventure, the adventure of the soul, than we were 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I look at my life trajectory, and I've done so many things in my 30 years of adulthood. I've forgotten half of my professions. And Tate, I don't think you'd dispute that. And I'm also thinking, Michael, what you just shared about this election we just had, it didn't go the way I wanted it to. And I felt something switch inside of me that felt my calling coming back a little. There was a rise in intensity in my calling of sorts. So I find that really interesting what you just shared.
Yeah, I'm with you. I feel like rededicating to the idea of finding more ways of healing and finding and maybe going back to working on the essence of rites of passage and figuring out, like you had asked Tate, how do we implement that now? And I hesitate to answer those things. First of all, I'm mythological, not practical. Mm-hmm. Unless we're in something, then I can get practical. Sure. But also I worry about dogma, and I worry about just creating a new formula that's applied. You know, I'm not a believer in the four steps or the 10 steps. I'm a believer in one good step or an endless number of steps. You know, if you're dancing, you don't want to have just two steps or four. And so how do you then implement something that by its nature is mysterious and hard to hold on to? And one answer to that is arts and practices. So one of the things that became clear to me early on working with men, because we would do these really deep week-long things, and everybody would be totally transcended, and people would learn stuff, and people would go back, and then they'd come back and want to do it again, and then it didn't work as well the second time. And one of the reasons was they hadn't worked with it enough to know how to take another step. And so then the question would be, well, what do we do then? And the answer would be, have an art, have a practice. You know, one of my practices is writing. I mean, I write books occasionally. I write every morning, though. I write dreams down. I write ideas down. I rework an idea I already wrote down. I'll put 3 to 5 hours a morning into that before I look at other things. But, and you had mentioned drumming. I got stumbled into rhythm and learning about music. And when a person, one way to get out of cynicism is play some music, learn how to play music. It's hard to be cynical if you're tapping on cymbals and drums. You kind of lose that cynicism because you are carried by a different rhythm. So I'm now a lot talking about three things. One, find an authentic way to live and then use arts and practices to sustain it. And just to say, in terms of men and men's work, traditional cultures all around the world that I've been able to study, men were always doing music and songs and also doing practices, including meditation practices or sitting in caves or whatever it might be. You can't become a man by going to work and then coming back home and going to work and coming back home. And now that the world has kind of fallen apart, it's more open for creating practices and arts that serve people in meaningful ways.
Yeah. When I was in the military, didn't tell you that, for 10 years in the Air Force. And I was, you know, reluctant. I did not want to be there. I didn't get thrown in solitary confinement, but it sure felt like I was in solitary.
You were already isolated.
I was pretty miserable. I was pretty unhappy. And it was then that I turned to music. Playing guitar and writing songs, and that definitely gave me a lifeline. I can really relate to that. And I heard you say something years ago. I don't remember the context, but something I was watching, you said that in the Celtic tradition, the practice was that before men could learn how to wield the sword, they had to learn how to dance.
Yeah. You don't give a man a weapon until you've taught him how to dance. And that means until a person is emotionally connected to the pulse of life and they understand something about human nature, you mm-hmm. don't give them a weapon. Mm. There was another old Irish idea. So the Irish initiatory group, the young men, would go, like in Africa, actually, they would go for about 3 months into nature each year, year after year. Mm. Everybody would go into nature. And of course, they had poetry, song. They had all working with all elements of nature, healing. They had all kinds of things to work on. And they would do it for 3 months every year so that you had to keep at this in order to keep growing. But anyway, it was in the process of doing that that they learned that you had to be able to carry your own ferocity and you had to be able to carry your own art. And so then when they came back, they were the guardians at the borders. We could call it now the immigration borders. They were the ones who stood on the borders of the province. And whenever anyone came, they would say, would you like a battle or a poem? In other words, they were armed.
So Irish.
And they were armed with poetry. And, and your choice. Love it. I would love to see that at the southern border as an immigration policy, you know, anyway. But that's people think you become a man by imitating people that look manly, when you're more likely to become a man by learning humility, like you talked about, and then learning some art and learning some practice that keeps us in touch with our soul. And someone pressured me once into saying, well, what is a man? And the only thing I could say is each man is unique unto himself. And if you're not becoming uniquely yourself, you might not be a man. And that's different from following steps that other people might take.
Well, this is such precious time. I'm so grateful for this time to spend with you, Michael. We live in a time where it is difficult to be optimistic, and with good reason. And you know, the human part of me definitely has fear, concerns. I can't minimize the real world things that are happening. And at the same time, to talk with you and explore these ideas and you know, even I think that's the gift of perhaps one of the gifts of myth and story is it takes us out of time, right? It takes us into another, you know, we didn't get into this, but Kairos versus Chronos time, it takes us into that Kairos time beyond time. And I find hope there. I find cause for optimism. In fact, not just cause for optimism, that's all there is optimism, because it's just the cycle. Like you said, life, death, rebirth. And I personally, I find that, you know, deeply, deeply, deeply comforting
And you could imagine that the more people who awaken, and awakening means feeling your pain as well as finding your gifts, the more people that awaken, then the less the period in darkness has to extend, you know. And the world doesn't change because people agree at some committee meeting. It changes soul by soul, soul by soul. And so it's great talking with you guys, because I can tell
Michael,
you.
Michael, what an honor.
You've been doing the work, and so that's great.
It's great. What are you working on these days? What do you want our audience to know? How can they find you, study with you? Tell us, please.
So we have a website, of course, mosaicvoices.org. We have a podcast comes out every week called Living Myth. I'm suggesting we are living in a myth, and we are agents of myth if we can awaken to the call. And then at the website, there's all kinds of, you know, there's books and there's courses and things like that. There's also free things. There's essays and things people can read. But the easiest access is through the podcast, where I do try to, on a weekly basis, weave together contemporary world with the world of imagination and mythology and psychology. That's that. And then what I'm working on now. So the next event I'm doing is called Arts and Practices. And I think the subtitle is something like Connections to Imagination and the Roots of Resilience and things like that. In other words, when we go down, we can follow like a taproot and get down to something we really need to grow the tree of our life. And then we go on from there, trying to suggest in each of the events where we find inspiration and imagination, and where we find ways to practice being ourselves, because it's not going to change soon. We're in the dark time, but what we do has an effect on how it changes.
Well, I'm struck, just in a final thought, Tate and I, just earlier this morning, we recorded another podcast with Douglas Gillette, whom you probably know personally, co-author of King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, among other books. And he also was talking about the importance of spending time in the imaginal realm, not imagination as in fantasy, as in not real, but in the imaginal, realm. And I've heard you use that similar terminology, that similar instruction, if you will, or invitation to spend time in creative imagining of, I don't know, you know, whatever happens in those places as a essential practice for these challenging times.
Yeah. In modern parlance, imagination is a superpower of each individual soul. Our power is not in intellect so much as it is in imagination. And we're here now to imagine another world. That's what we have to do to get out of the collapsing of the one we're in. So yeah, imagination is key.
Well, I feel renewed. I feel grateful again, Michael. This is truly, precious to spend this time with you. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with both of you and great to know the things you're doing and good luck with all that.
Yeah.
And you know,
thank
be
you.
Well.
Thank you.
The struggle.
I say this to a certain kind of guest, but Brian and I revere elders like you who have been paving the way for decades and whom we get to learn from in ways like this and in other ways. We stand on what you have done, and our culture is, you know, just in debt to the work that you have been doing. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for that.